Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has called for an investigation into a weekend-long killing spree in the country's northern Cabo Delgado province. In a statement, Mr. Guterres condemned reports of wanton brutality following reports of massacres by non-state armed groups in several villages. In addition to multiple beheadings, which state media said took place at a football ground, women and children were also kidnapped. The Secretary-General urged the country's authorities to conduct an investigation and hold those responsible to account. He also called on all parties to the conflict to abide by their obligations under international law and repeated the UN's commitment to continue supporting the country's immediate humanitarian needs, its efforts to uphold human rights, promote development, and prevent violent extremism. The attacks are the latest violence aimed at civilians in the province, which is rich in natural gas and gemstones. Social media platforms should use big data and artificial intelligence to eliminate trafficking in women and girls, a UN Rights Committee has said. The Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, in Geneva, said on Wednesday that women and girls continue to bear the brunt of the illegal trade. Its call to social media firms for better controls against traffickers and protection for victims stems from an increase in the use of online traps during the COVID-19 pandemic. Those behind the trafficking networks enjoy widespread impunity, despite national and international laws and policies designed to tackle the problem, the panel said. Online, demand has been channeled through social media, dark web, and messaging platforms, which provide easy access to potential victims but hide the identity of the perpetrators, the committee said. Among its recommendations, the panel urged the online platforms to use their big data, artificial intelligence, and analytics to identify any pattern that could lead to trafficking and help to identify those involved. Online firms should also put in place the appropriate governance structure and procedures which will allow them to be reactive in their response and provide the relevant level of information to the concerned authorities, the UN panel said. Many millions of people are stateless around the world, an affront to humanity, the head of the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has said. In a message calling for an end to statelessness by 2024, Filippo Grandi said that action was needed now more than ever, as the coronavirus crisis has left nationless people around the world without access to jobs or healthcare. It was in no one's interest for people to be left stateless and living on the margins of society, vulnerable to disease, said Mr. Grandi. He insisted that resolving statelessness came down to political will, and that the consequences of inaction, especially during the middle of a pandemic, can be life-threatening. Finally, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed has visited communities displaced by violence in northeast Nigeria as part of a solidarity tour of West Africa and the Sahel to show support to countries during the COVID-19 pandemic. Ms. Mohammed travelled to Borno State in northeastern Nigeria, a region that's been badly affected by years of conflict and where communities have been targeted by armed extremists. In the town of Banki, near Nigeria's border with Cameroon, she spoke to displaced people sheltering at a protection camp and Nigerian refugees returning from Cameroon. The UN deputy chief said that thousands there clearly want to go home to resume their livelihoods and get access to basic services. Ms. Mohammed also warned that many in the region faced malnutrition linked to food insecurity in a call for collective action to prevent widespread hunger next year. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in the wake of the presidential election, we're joined by Margaret Kimberly of the Black Agenda Report.
With the publication of her book, Prejudicial, Kimberly has become widely recognized as one of the most articulate, far-seeing spokespersons on the left.
We're also joined by D.C. Attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund.
Mara Verheyden-Hilliard is one of the great constitutional litigators in the country.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We are recording this interview with Margaret Kimberly on November 4th, the day after the election. Over 90 million people voted early. Ballots are still being counted. Trump doesn't even want them counted and is relying on the Supreme Court to back him up on that. In the year 2000, the Supreme Court stopped the counting of ballots in Dade County, Florida, thus allowing George W. Bush to steal the election. Trump wants to be able to say, as former Nicaraguan dictator Somoza bragged, "It is true, you won the voting, but I won the counting." The overwhelming consensus on the left was to hold your nose, vote for Biden, and then attempt to influence him when he takes office. Biden kept a low profile during the campaign. He didn't have much to say programmatically. His strongest appeal was that he was not Trump, whom Noam Chomsky called the most dangerous man in human history. The eco-socialist Green Party, led by Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker, got very little attention from neither the mainstream media or the left-center media. Hawkins' campaign was vilified, with critics stating that a vote for Greens was tantamount to a vote for Trump. The Democratic Party in Wisconsin went so far as to help successfully prevent Hawkins and Walker from staying on the ballot there, in a state where Walker had filed her papers and then had changed her home address. Regardless of how people on the left voted, the immediate question, which is always the key political question, is what are we going to do next? We speak today with Green Party supporter Margaret Kimberly. She's the senior editor at Black Agenda Report and the author of the widely read book, Prejudicial. Margaret Kimberly, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Margaret, what kind of support did Biden and the Democratic Party get from Wall Street, Silicon Valley, the major media, the intelligence agencies, the military, and a number of Republicans?
Well, to give a broad answer, he got a lot of support from all of those individuals and all those interest groups. But as we can see, we still don't know who the winner is. They're counting votes, which means it was very close. So while all of those people, Wall Street, big tech, corporate media, all of them are on the Democratic side of the duopoly, and as for intelligence agencies and the military, they are, in a way, nonpartisan. Many of them go from administration to administration, from Democrats to Republicans. And the Republicans who back Biden, the so-called Never Trumpers, the Lincoln Project, and so forth, are still Republicans. But that tells us that Biden is, in effect, running as a Republican. And the fact that it is so close also tells us that this elite support doesn't mean a lot to millions of people. That is, I think, the major takeaway here. Elite opinion doesn't count, and we're seeing this for the second presidential election in a row.
Margaret, why did they all support him? And what would have happened had Bernie run instead?
Well, they support him because he supports them. There was the CEO of Boeing said a couple of months ago that he didn't care who won. And that told us what we needed to know. He knew that Boeing and the rest of the military industrial complex was going to do just, we were super PACs backing Biden. They know he is going to do the things they want him to do. It's very simple. So we have the oligarchs raising money, guaranteeing act, and the end result is a policy platform that leaves the people out. Had it been Bernie Sanders, but one of the reasons it's not Bernie Sanders is that these people did not want him. And that's why it was rigged against him for a second time. So we have a party that's beholden to these interests. It has been wholly captured by them. And that means the Democrats will not allow a progressive to get the nomination. Any progressive who wants to run for president is going to have to do so outside of the Democrats.
Margaret, most of the people who consider themselves leftist supported Biden. What justifications did they articulate for doing so?
Well, it was just Trump is the worst. He's an existential threat. He's the most racist, the most fascist. And whatever issues we have with Biden, it is harm reduction. It is a heart attack as opposed to stage 4 cancer. There were even people who I know folks who ordinarily, because they live in a so-called safe state, that is to say not a swing state, a state that's wholly red or blue, feel free to vote their conscience and do as I do and vote for the Green Party. But even New Yorkers, where Biden had a huge lead all along, his victory was not in doubt, I even heard people like that saying, we had to vote for Biden. We had to run up the score against Trump. It was important for Trump to be completely repudiated. There was also the hangover from 2016, where the Greens were blamed for the Democratic Party loss. And I think it's those things that cause people to allow themselves to be herded into the Biden camp.
The people that supported Biden, the leftists that supported him, said that they'd give, if Biden won, that would give us some space to organize and that he would be easier to push towards the left. But we're really talking about is social change, aren't we? What does social change, where does it come from?
Well, it comes from not relying on the electoral process. Just as an example, everyone talks a lot about the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Because it was independent of the electoral process. People made demands to politicians that they knew politicians did not want to meet. They knew they were in an adversarial relationship with them, but they persisted and made their demands anyway. And by creating this crisis in the system, they were able to get many successes from the system. So the social change comes from the people. It comes in spite of the political party. And, when people say that Biden will give you space to organize, I don't know what they mean. The last few weeks of the campaign, the Biden team kept bragging about Republicans who supported him. Cindy McCain supports Biden. This one supports Biden. That one is a never-Trumper, which told us we were getting a Republican administration, the Republicans of old. We can organize no matter who the president is. But I'm afraid that the fact that people still say that means they don't really understand the importance of organizing or, frankly, how to go about doing it.
If you will, please talk a bit more about why you support the Green Party.
Well, I have to vote my conscience. It started little by little when I realized how the Electoral College worked and that my vote in New York State didn't count. I felt free to vote for whomever I wanted. But then over time, I realized that by voting for the Democrats, I was voting for things I did not want. For example, foreign policy, defense spending, all those issues are important to me. But as I just said, there is no difference between the two parties in regard to those two things. We cannot have a system where military spending eats up 60% of the discretionary budget and get any of our needs met. That's one of the reasons the COVID has been so bad. It's not just Trump's incompetence. We have a system that has got to be, it's got to be torn up. And we have to start thinking about a new society. Some people use the term post-capitalist. You can use any kind of terminology that you like, but voting in Democrats was not really going to, it does not, we've seen it, does not move the needle. We see people who are beholden to one wing of the oligarchy as opposed to another. So I had no problem in finally becoming a member of the Green Party.
But if you were not in New York, if you were in a swing state, would you have thought differently, considering that Trump supports maximizing the use of fossil fuels and the elimination of any restraints on that? And that, of course, is leading us to a disaster. Chomsky says that Trump, quote, is dedicating his efforts perfectly consciously to destroy the prospect for human life on Earth. How do you respond to Chomsky and people who made that argument?
Well, I believe it's the responsibility of the Democrats to win. I don't understand why Democrats are so willing to let them off the hook, to never make them accountable. It's up to them to get their voters. It's up to them to look at each state and determine how best to win. It's nobody else's responsibility. And frankly, it's an admission of guilt. If the Democrats depend on another party, another group of people who have made the conscious decision not to be Democrats, it tells you how they have failed. It's also an admission that they need the left. If they need the left, they need to act like it. As for Trump being an existential threat to the planet, let's look at what the Democrats really do with the environment. Barack Obama left office and continues to brag that he increased oil production during his time in office. Biden has said over and over again he was not going to end fracking, something that does great damage, poisons the water, causes earthquakes. It's awful. So I don't know what this big difference is. You know, Democrat the environment, but they really don't, in fact, do anything that's very different. We can't have capitalist parties and save the planet, and the Democrats are a capitalist party, too.
Margaret, Delaware Senator Ted Kaufman, who's heading the Biden transition team, recently told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "When we get in, the pantry is going to be bare because of all the deficits that Trump built up with the income tax cuts. So we're going to be limited." Do you believe there's an alternative to the austerity plan he's announcing?
Sure there is. The just spend the money. Stop with the austerity. But austerity is it's a bigger issue than just government spending. It's about the interests that we've been talking about, who want to have a society where people live as precarious a life as possible, have as little ability to confront them as possible. So they do not want government spending, even though the Fed has said, go ahead, spend the money, pass another stimulus bill. So that's why we aren't going to get what it is we really need. But this is ridiculous. They have money for a space force. They have money. The defense budget is now $740 billion. It's bigger than the defense budgets of the next 10 countries combined. All these countries that we're told are adversaries spend a minuscule portion of money on defense that we do. So there's money. There's money when they want it. There's money to give to Ukraine. There's money for a space force. There's money for everything else. And it is ridiculous to believe that Joe Biden can't spend money on the people, too.
We're speaking with Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report. Margaret recently wrote Prejudicial, a wonderful book which I recommend everybody read. We interviewed Margaret months ago when it came out. Margaret, Biden bragged about winning the nomination over Bernie Sanders. He said, quote, "I beat the socialist." Why do you think that Biden always obliged Trump by denying he would do anything that rank-and-file Democrats wanted, and that he would, in fact, have increased his chances of winning had he done that? Don't you think so?
Yeah, I think so. He would have. But that's the very thing the Democrats need to do. This, you know, the bloom is off the rose with Obama and someone who markets himself well, but you still get neoliberalism. They've got to do something to get those voters who are left out because their needs aren't addressed. But that would mean confronting the people whose support they are now determined to keep. So they want to win by nibbling around the edges. There's a small number of issues that they claim make them different. The Supreme Court, for example, and with the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that has emerged as being important. I'm not saying it isn't important, but they don't do the work they need to do in order to make sure they control the Senate. Apparently, the presidential election isn't in doubt. It's not clear who's going to control the Senate either. But Biden wants to run as a Republican, but doesn't want to admit it. And Trump, who occasionally can be smart, he knows it. So he will bait him with issues like that. But so that forces Biden to say he isn't who most Democrats want him to be. And that cuts down on his support. But we've seen, I believe the Democrats want to win, but they're willing to take the chance and not win rather than ruffle the feathers of their powerful backers.
Margaret, let's talk about the Supreme Court being packed with right-wingers. Howard Zinn observed once that, quote, "It would be naive to depend on the Supreme Court to defend the rights of poor people, women, people of color, dissidents of all kinds. Those rights come about when citizens protest, demonstrate, strike, boycott, rebel, and violate the law in order to uphold justice. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I believe that's true. We, you know, it is one of the reasons that it's important not for one, the most right-wing party to have control of the federal judiciary. That is true. But it's also true that, you know, being one of the bodies that controls our federal government, that Democrats fail constantly. So when they lose, you know, Obama, nobody wants to talk about this, but Obama lost, the Democrats lost more than 900 seats when Obama was president. And that's in state legislatures and in the House and the Senate. Those losses in the states mean that Republicans get to gerrymander. It means they get to control districts. It means they get to control the Senate. So I think it's important to talk about how their capitulations have led to this disaster. We do have these famous Supreme Court decisions, Brown v. Board of Ed in 1954, and the case that won us our Miranda rights and so on. But we can't depend on that happening. That's why Democrats have to be more serious about controlling the legislature and passing. They act as though, you know, they don't have the power to do these things that they are. And it's the main way they browbeat people into sticking with them is to constantly talk about the courts. Well, the courts loom so large because they fail legislatively so often. So, yes, I believe in the power of movements. I believe that you can't back these parties who don't even know how to win elections. And that's another reason I'm a Green. It isn't as though the Democrats are so successful at the ballot. So they're asking you to uphold people who, you know, when push comes to shove, are less interested in winning than they are in making sure that their part of the duopoly supports them.
Why do you think that African Americans, who are the most progressive part of the American population on both domestic policies and issues of war and peace, got behind Biden?
It's very sad that black politics, for a variety of reasons over the decades, has diminished so much that now it amounts to nothing more than keeping Republicans out of office. So the idea of organizing, the idea of working outside of the system, because that has diminished so badly, the only thing black voters feel like they can do is to keep a Republican out of office. And all you need to do to get them on board is to cast doubt on anyone other than the favored candidate winning. So how do you turn black people against Bernie Sanders? Simple. You just tell them he can't win. Well, you may want Medicare for all, or you may want your student loan debt forgiven, but Sanders can't win and Biden can. So you just repeat the mantra of electability, and people will not follow their political instincts or their best interests.
The Black Agenda Report has been a leader in articulating and popularizing the concept of the black misleadership class. What is that, and how does Kamala Harris fit in?
Well, the black misleadership class, they're, you know, not just politicians, but leaders of the traditional civil rights organizations, other prominent people, and they give cover to the Democratic Party. So you see someone like Congressman Clyburn in South Carolina, who was the kingmaker for Biden. We'll see how much of a king he made once all the ballots are counted, though. Kamala Harris, of course, all of them, anyone in Congress, especially those in the Senate, where you have to raise millions of dollars in order to win, are also part of the misleadership class. And Kamala Harris is, having been a prosecutor, has acted in her professional life more overtly against the interests of black people, because prosecutors, their job is to lock people up, especially black people. She was no different in that regard. But having won her Senate seat, she became a favorite day after Biden announced that she was going to be his running mate. You saw these headlines in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street breathes a sigh of relief. Well, that tells you that the choice of Kamala Harris didn't have anything to do with what the people wanted, but it had to do with what the donor class wanted. And that's what all of them do. Harris is, you know, in fact, biracial, and for a variety of reasons is less accepted as being a black person than Obama was. But she is counted as a black person enough that she is one of these people who works to give the Democratic Party cover and to keep black people from making any change or exiting from the Democratic Party.
The Democratic Party is known as the place where social movements go to die. Talk about the Black is Back Coalition and their relationship to the Democratic Party, please.
Well, the Black is Back Coalition is an independent formation. They act independently of all of the political parties. They have, I know they've run candidates for local office. They have their annual March on the White House this weekend. But they don't have much of a relationship with the Democrats. They advocate for self-determination for black people, and that means not having an allegiance to necessarily to the Democratic Party. They advocate that black people, that as a group, we advocate for our needs, our specific needs. And that's one of the things that has been so diminished over the years. But they make a very good case that that is our road to political success. I happen to believe that black people will be the losers, whether Trump is declared the winner or Biden is.
Margaret, what does the Green Party advocate for with respect to unemployment, health care, minimum wage, racism, and climate change?
Well, the Green Party is on the right side, that is to say the correct side, on all of these issues. They argue for Medicare for All, that the United States ought to have a health care system like the rest of the countries we always compare ourselves to, like right next door in Canada, like they have. That the minimum wage be raised so that more people have living wage jobs. And the Green Party, like in the U.S., like all Green parties, are in favor of policies that diminish the impact of climate change, lessening dependence on fossil fuels, that the government, the Green New Deal, the real Green New Deal that the Green Party popularized first and the Democrats stole and watered down, that also be a part of be an employment plan, that people be employed in new sustainable industries and businesses, that the country can convert to a green economy and also employ people. So you don't have situations like in, say, West Virginia, where people are told, well, you know, Pete, the coal industry provides jobs, so if you get rid of coal, then you're going to be out of work. So that is what the Green Party advocates. The Green Party advocates for reparations for past harm done to black people. They don't call themselves socialists, but I see it as a socialist formation, and it's why one of the reasons I am a member of the Greens.
Do they have a future? I mean, what do they need to do to expand their support?
Well, we're up against it, to be honest. Here, one of the reactions to the 2016 loss that was in large part blamed on the Green Party is that Democrats across the country have worked hard to get Greens off the ballot. Here in New York State, Governor Cuomo, under the guise of campaign finance reform, passed this new rule that says parties must, in order to get a ballot line in New York State, have to get at least 2% presidential election year. That would mean the Green Party would have to nearly double the number of votes they got in 2016, which isn't going to happen. That's happening across the country. Though in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, they found various ruses to take the Greens off altogether. There are other states that have done a similar job. So we've got a lot of work to do. And we have to make sure that we're in front on these issues that the Democrats ignore. We should be the face of living wage work, the face of housing, the face of these very basic issues that neither of the two major parties ever talk about. I think that's the only way for us to come out of what is now a very challenging situation. But I also think that as time goes on, as the situation worsens in a variety of ways, I think people will be more willing to look at something else. Those people who have taken themselves out of the system, the millions of people who don't bother to vote at all. I'm not wishing, you know, difficulties and misery on people, but I think that is coming regardless of who is sworn in January, and the Greens have to be ready to capitalize on that.
Margaret, how can people follow you online?
Sure. I'm a columnist at Black Agenda Report, so blackagendareport.com. We publish every Wednesday, but blackagendareport.com every week. I am on Twitter. My handle is freedomrideblog, and I also have a Patreon, patreon.com/Margaret Kimberly.
Margaret Kimberly, it's really been a pleasure to speak with you, and we're so grateful that you carved out the time to be on Law and Disorder. We thank you very much, and we look forward to speaking with you again. You take it easy.
Thank you so much. Great to be back. I look forward to the next time.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Days before last week's November 3rd presidential election, many businesses across the nation boarded up their storefronts in anticipation of violent street protests. Many believed that if President Donald Trump lost the election, or even if he said he refused to accept election results, that civil unrest would prevail. And even if Joe Biden is declared the lawful winner, Donald Trump has announced that he will challenge the results and take it to the Supreme Court. But there's also a larger issue. While mass uprising in the streets over the last past year have altered the social discourse around racism and other inequities, several larger issues still are at play, determined to keep Donald Trump in office. Joining us today to discuss some of the factors informing Donald Trump's popularity is D.C. Attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. Mara is Executive Director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund in Washington, D.C. Mara, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
As you know better than most, this past year's street uprisings are clearly having an impact on public opinion. Mainstream newspapers are publishing editorials and op-eds calling for defunding or even abolishing the police. Still, the American voting public seems to prefer racist policies and a racist candidate. Why do you think that's so?
I don't know if we can say with certainty that the American public as a whole is voting with a preference based on racism. That doesn't seem to be either what the numbers show or what the sentiment really is. I think there's a lot of factors in play, including racism, but I don't know that that's the dominant factor that is behind all of the support for Trump. In many ways, he is able to run and has been running, even in the midst of the pandemic, on the pandemic itself and the economic impact on people. And of course, he uses racism endlessly and repeatedly to try and invigorate his base that is racist, but that base isn't enough to carry the day.
What's your take on why Biden didn't perform that well? What was his strategy?
Well, obviously, as we're recording, we don't know the outcome yet. But going back to what I was saying about what happened with Trump and with the pandemic and how the race has played itself out, you know, you could see that the incredible economic devastation for so many people, which should rightly fall at the feet of Trump because of his policies, because of his failure to protect the American public at the onset, because of the complete failures to implement public health measures that would have helped people, the failures to provide economic relief efficiently for people. Nonetheless, he has successfully run diverting all of those responsibilities and pointing to the Democrats, including Pelosi and the Democrats in Congress and in the Senate, for these failures. And Biden and the Democratic Party as a whole have not been able or have been unwilling, really, to counter that head on and to fight back. Because really early on, if the Democrats had insisted and fought for a relief program that was styled on European capitalism, that provided in Europe, you know, they were providing people up to 80% of their salaries while they were at home and under lockdown. In the United States, they took all of that money and they fed it to corporations, to banks, to hedge funds, but not directly to the people. And in doing that and not providing people that actual economic relief, just leaving it up to the niceties of their employers as to whether or not they would continue to pay them. People left in the lurch because in America they get their health insurance through the employer instead of through a public system that protects them. This left so many people vulnerable, and they in turn then were blaming the Democratic Party for not reopening the economy and providing them relief. So this is like a perfect setup where Trump can then run on the reopen platform, say that the Democrats are the ones who are shutting things down, and they're the ones that are driving people into bankruptcy.
Are we seeing the rise of the so-called silent majority, the fears of racial justice and challenges to capitalism?
You know, it's interesting. The numbers as of right now look like Biden lost ground among Black and Latino voters even, which again goes back to the issue of the economic, what's in play in terms of the economic issues and Trump's ability to blame the Democrats for the economic issues, where the Democrats, of course, had they put forward like a bold protective agenda for people, could have made a difference. And the fact that Biden, while on one hand was trying to appeal to white voters and really to more reactionary voters, somehow thinking that he could get some of the Trump voters and again believing that those voters are necessarily backwards, was then walking away from a bold progressive agenda that actually speaks to working people. And an agenda that would offer people relief, would offer them the capacity to feed their families, to see their doctors. That kind of agenda could really make the difference and drive people to the polls, but instead there was a decision made to really try and speak to a Trump agenda in many ways, including when it comes to issues of climate justice and climate catastrophe. The endless speeches about how Biden is, you know, for fracking, again, because they're just endlessly trying to talk to the Trump people that they presume have particular views instead of engaging and getting so many people who otherwise might have been excited to vote and other people who would have been very happy to think that they actually would get relief. And particularly, again, if they had gotten relief through a European-style program of relief of giving people 80% salaries, which was completely doable with the amount of money that was spent. So I think, you know, in terms of what we're seeing about that descriptor of the silent majority or people coming forward who are now feeling emboldened when it comes to the overt and open racism and voting on that kind of plan and platform, yes, that exists. I mean, that's a real thing. There are certainly a lot of people in the United States of racists who feel like they have been shut down for the past 40 years from the growth of the civil rights movement and through efforts towards racial justice in America. But again, they're not a majority. I don't think they're a majority at all. Remember, Obama was able to win with many of these same voters who then turned around and voted for Trump.
Speaking of the past few years, Mara, what do you think would have happened had Bernie Sanders run instead of Joe Biden?
It's certainly a real possibility that Sanders would have been in a better position to take on Trump just in a straightforward fashion had he continued with the language and the policies that were exciting so many people throughout his campaign, because he is able to talk to the needs of working class people in the United States. And for all of Biden's, you know, working class, I'm just the regular Joe presentation, it doesn't really resonate with people, and it doesn't appear to have resonated with people, because you have to back that up with offering actual relief policies, programs that support working people. And Biden didn't do that and hasn't done that. So Sanders was doing that. And when Sanders was polling against Trump, when Sanders was taking Trump on the issues, he was doing better. And the only reason that Sanders, was knocked out of the race was because there was a decision made just before Super Tuesday, clearly by Democratic Party elite, that they were going to get rid of him and that they were going to put Biden in, who had been losing. And there was a coordinated effort, and you could see what happened on Super Tuesday with the sudden turn of events to remove Sanders because it looked like he really was going to become the nominee.
So why do you think there's so much opposition in the mainstream to mass protests?
You know, some of the mainstream media coverage, I think, has been a lot more favorable to protests and mass assembly since the murder of George Floyd and the demonstrations throughout the United States. Many reporters who are on the front lines who've been attacked can see exactly the viciousness of the police. And many people have been coming out and participating in protests and demonstrations who never had before. And the protest movement is really growing in the United States because an awful lot of people are feeling like the existing processes don't reflect the will of the people and may not be the ultimate responses for creating the change that we need to have. And that's certainly true when you look at the climate catastrophe. I mean, you have no candidate who is running who is going to take the bold action that's necessary right now. I mean, certainly Biden as a candidate looks a lot better than Trump in many regards when it comes to the climate catastrophe, but that's an awful low bar. But in terms of doing what actually has to happen for the world not to dissolve in flames in the relatively near term, he's not promoting those programs or policies either. It is going to be up to the people to be in the streets to fight for these issues. And the same thing when it comes to racial justice and the endless murder of black people by the police state. Those changes are coming because people are in the streets, not because at the ballot box there's been a determination of reform. And as more and more people protest, yes, of course, there's often mainstream coverage that demonizes, that tries to make it look criminal when it's not criminal. The vast majority of demonstrations in the United States have been completely peaceful. I think because more and more people are actually engaging in protests, more and more people are seeing for themselves, too, what this means and that power of feeling you have when you're out in the streets with other people and feel like you can and will change the world.
I understand that there are at least 8 individuals who've been blinded by rubber bullets. Talk about what you see, especially in the last several months in D.C. with people putting their lives on the line right now. Do you think that's going to continue?
I think it's absolutely continuing no matter what, because you could see it before the elections, during this election season. You'd see it over the summer. Sparked again by yet another police murder, and then another police murder, and then another police murder. People are feeling very strongly that this is what they must do in order to change society. There is no question about that, and that's a real truth. The fact is that unless people are in the streets and people are making the demands and people are forcing change, that change is not going to come. I think in terms of the pandemic, when people are out in the streets and the demonstrations that I've seen and that I've been at, I mean, people are well masked up, and there haven't been huge spikes in COVID infections around demonstrations that have been documented that certainly that I'm aware of. Nothing like going inside a restaurant or, you know, inside other locations where it transmits much more freely. But the real threat does come from police violence and from government crackdown and attacks on the ability of people to assemble and speak out. The violence from the police is extreme. It is vicious. It is brutal. It is completely unchecked in many regards, except for the civil rights lawyers who are fighting from location to location and state to state to try and push the police back, to try and strip them of the violent weapons that they're using that they should not be allowed to use against people who are engaged in First Amendment activity, to try and get some measure of accountability where they can. I mean, that's a struggle that's a really important fight right now in order to keep the space open, to keep the streets open, to allow people to be out and to be able to express themselves and to demand change. And we're seeing that people are coming out over and over and over again. I think many people, in a way, are getting used to the idea of the police violence. It doesn't make it acceptable, but they understand that this is something that they have to face in order to move forward, and they are doing that.
Marva Hayden-Hildred, you're the head of the Partnership for Civil Justice. You're a constitutional litigator. And what happened last night at 2:21 a.m. in the White House, Trump announced, and he had the Marine Band play Hail to the Chief, and he announced that he had won the election, even though ballots are still being counted. And he also announced that he was going to go to the Supreme Court to stop further counting of the ballots, and that he was going to remain as the president. And the Washington Post said that he was subverting democracy and that this was shocking. What was your reaction when you heard what he did last night? And what do you think is going to happen?
Well, he is trying to subvert any semblance of democracy. I mean, the fact is what he's trying to do at this moment is make sure that the votes of people are not counted, most specifically trying to stop the votes of many black people in the United States. It's a form of disenfranchisement to try and keep what he wants, which is to maintain the presidency. I do think that this was anticipated. Many of us expected that if he thought that he was losing, he would definitely attempt to declare himself president and try and line others up around him and behind him. He's also trying to signal to his base that if there is any other declaration of who's a president, and that if there is a declaration that Biden has won, that he is now setting the stage to assert that this is false, that it's fraudulent, that it's stolen. I think we've all learned over the last 4 years that there is really nothing that Trump won't do. So the idea of being shocked at any point by his actions has, you know, become almost an impossibility. But, you know, he is setting the stage for an extreme level of disorientation, dysfunction, and discrediting of these processes in the United States.
Mara, in our remaining minutes, can you give our listeners a snapshot of what the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund is working on now?
Yes, I'd be very glad to. In fact, particular to this moment, we have just announced a new project, which is called the Center for Protest Law and Litigation, which is, you can learn more about it at protestlaw.org. That's protestlaw.org. This is an initiative building on 25 years of work where we have litigated and taken on police agencies around the country. We have won significant changes in police law and practices, changes in laws restricting police conduct, and defending protesters whose rights have been violated, who are being criminally prosecuted, fighting not just police, but federal law enforcement as well. And so this center, at this particular moment in time, is, we believe, so necessary in order to provide a coordinated response to defend the movement for justice in the United States and to be coordinated all around the country in terms of legal defense and affirmative civil rights litigation, So we urge everyone to join with us at protestlaw.org for the new Center for Protest Law and Litigation, because ultimately everything that we believe in, everything that we're fighting for, is going to come from people in the streets fighting and making those demands and being uncompromising and refusing to give in. And historically, every single change in the United States that has moved us forward has come exactly by those means. That is really the origin of all progressive change.
That's so well said, Mara, and best of luck with the new initiative.
I think every single person who cares about the state of society needs to find other like-minded people if they have not already, find any organization and join it. You have to be with other people, even in these circumstances where we're under lockdown or where we're at home, where we're being careful, even people who can't risk going out to a demonstration because they are vulnerable or live with vulnerable people, that's completely understandable. But there are so many ways to plug in. Everybody should join an organization. And of course, we would urge everyone to please join with us at the Center for Protest Law and Litigation, because we believe that acting together, we know that that's the power that will make the difference. And just even looking at this election season tells us so much about the limits of the ballot box. The change that really has to be in partnership with all the levers of democracy that are at our disposal. We can't rely on any single one thing.
Well, one thing we can rely on, Mara, is that the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund will continue to be there to defend protesters and their right to take it to the streets. Thank you so much.
And we so much admire your good work. We'll get you back on the show, and you can hopefully announce some victories in the near future.
Thank you.
Michael, we could use some more WBAI buddies to support our favorite station.
With Trump declaring from the White House the election was fraudulent and that he will not leave and he'll challenge the results, opens up a period of great challenges for us. It also gives us an opportunity to reach out and speak out over the airwaves of WBAI, and that's where we need your help. Please go to the internet and make a donation to WBAI. That's givetowbai.org. That's give to, the numeral two, givetowbai.org. We could use your help. The program could use your help. We need to keep this vital communication line open. Thank you so much in advance for your support.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasseloff. 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF-FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM, 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5 Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill, 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM Media Net, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSCR FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS LPFM 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The I, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont, Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska, KRDILP, 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington, WUMD, 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, KWRKLP, 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRN, LP, 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC, 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYR, LP, 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising Online. KBFG 107.3, Seattle, Washington, and KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB LP 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODX LP 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJP LP 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m.